Morning. Hi. So this morning I'm going to start by telling a story about a boy around 10 or 11 years old. You may have heard this story before, but not in a few years. this boy is in the Wind Rivers in Wyoming, hiking with his parents, and they're staying at a camp, and they decide to climb a 14,000-foot peak. And the boy, of course, has never done anything like this before. But he's excited, and his dad gets him a map, and there's trail signs along the way for the first part, with just saying exactly how far you've gone. So the first part of the hike, the boy is doing pretty well, and he keeps looking at the trail sign. Dad, I've done another quarter of a mile, another quarter of a mile, another quarter of a mile, look, another quarter of a mile, et cetera, et cetera. You know, looking at the trail signs, looking at the map, and it distracts him from his discomfort that he's feeling as he's getting higher. And this goes on for a while, and then they get to a point where there's no trail anymore. There's just the map, and this is a little disorienting for the boy, because he can't see how well he's doing, how far he's got to go. He can't keep himself occupied, so he begins to feel a little more of his aches and pains, and a little more of his being out of breath, and a little more worried about what he's got himself into. And so he keeps going with his parents, and his parents are with him, but they seem to be a little ways ahead of him. And then they come to timberline, and where timberline, all of a sudden the trees are all gone, and the map shows nothing at timberline, because the timberline is flat, it's the same contours, so the map doesn't work. There's no trail. He's at timberline, and so he has nothing to go by, except his mom and dad up there in front walking. So he begins to really hurt emotionally and psychologically and physically, because he feels his pain more, and it gets so bad that he just feels like quitting. Although it's not really any worse than it was before. It's just that he doesn't have that. He doesn't have that that internal guide that we all depend on. So he gets teary and he feels like stopping, but he sees his mom and dad they're kind of slowing down, and they're continuing. So he just sticks with it, even though he's by now just teary all the way down. And at some point, all of a sudden, he begins to notice things around him that he didn't notice when he was on the trail, when he had the trail, and then when he had the map. But he begins to notice the sky. He begins to notice the rocks. He begins to notice that his legs, while there's some pain in them, that they can just move one step after another. that he doesn't have to monitor how much farther he's got to go. That they just do that, and so there's a little transformation that takes place, or maybe a big transformation, and he's just there walking, just one step, one step, one step, and it's quite wonderful, and he loses a sense of time, and then the first thing he knows, he's at the top of the mountain, and his mom says, "Look, Johnny, you're at the top. We're at the top." He said, "Oh." He looks at the sky, and it's wonderful, but it's the same sky that he experienced just a few minutes before. She said, sign your name here. You're probably the youngest boy to have ever done this. He said, he kind of looks at her. The youngest boy to have done what? To have taken another step? To have accomplished what? Because he's in a different place. He's in the place that is just being. And that's the story. That's the preface to my talk today. Maybe I should make that my whole talk. You probably like that better. I'd probably like that better. I spent too many time. My wife says, why are you always reading these books, Tim? Well, I never read novels. She said, why don't you enjoy a novel? I said, well, I like these books. She said, oh, come on. No, I do like them. I'm sorry. So today I want to talk about the path from delusion to enlightenment, which I talked a little bit about with the people who are going to be initiated on September 29th, yesterday. I hope you'll come to that. But I'm going to talk about it more in more detail. The path, this is what Buddhist practice is about. It's the path from samsara to nirvana. It's the path from our confused mind to having clarity, to having openness, to having stillness. That's the path. So I'm going to talk about it from three different perspectives, okay? I'm going to talk about it from the perspective of early Buddhism, which it then turns into modern-day Theravada Buddhism. And I decided to talk about this because of our Dhammapada class. I'm stopping because a couple people are coming in. And then I'm going to talk about it from the Chinese perspective, using the two strands that come out of the Chinese perspective. So three different maps, okay? The first map is the early Buddhist map, the modern-day Theravada map. Linear, easy to follow, rational. You start with the first step on the Eightfold Path, which is understanding. From that understanding, you go to inspiration and aspiration and intention. Those are the cognitive components. From those cognitions, you go to the behavioral components, speech, action, and livelihood. If you get mixed up on the behavioral components, you come back to the cognitive components. So it's cognitive behavioral. Anytime you're not doing speech, action, and livelihood in an appropriate way that feels good and that is based on interdependence, you come back to the cognitions that are creating that. So it's as I was saying yesterday, it's cognitive behavioral, well, not therapy, but cognitive behavioral. Therapy is something extra because you do it yourself, right? I guess. And then you move on to the meditative components. And when the meditative components don't work, you go back to the behavioral components because of the behavioral components, meditation's not working. Or the cognitive components. It's just nicely delineated, nicely laid out. It also includes not only the Eightfold Path, but the six paramitas. You do the six paramitas over and over again. Giving morality, patience, effort, meditation, and wisdom over and over again. And the belief in this map, the way this map, this path, this well-delineated path, is that you won't necessarily attain enlightenment in this lifetime. It doesn't matter. You may or may not have a little enlightenment experience, but you just do the path. Some lifetime or other, you will. But the path has 53 stages. It does. I don't know how they came up with 53. It has 53 stages. And so maybe in this lifetime you'll have a little enlightenment, maybe you won't. But if you're doing the cognitive behavioral work and the meditative work, that's all you need to do. You don't need to be greedy. And some lifetime or other, you might have some enlightenment, right? Okay. So that's the... And in terms of the meditation practice, that's also very clearly and precisely laid out, how you do it. There's a method, there's a system. Shamatha vipassana, right? Shamatha, You do the calming exercises, exercises to calm down, the shamatha exercises. When you've done those well enough, then you're ready for vipassana part, which is the labeling. The labeling anger when it comes up, the labeling fear when it comes up, the labeling whatever. So you just, and then if you just get lost by that stuff, you come back to the shamatha. Again, very well delineated, very rational, and very dualistic, but not in a negative sense. They think that's cool. Mahayana says it's not cool. They say that's cool. People need this kind of thing. This is how we learn. This is how human beings learn and how we transform ourselves. And that is part of, that's part of our tradition here in Zen, too. I'm talking about three that are part of our tradition. I could be talking about Tibetan. I don't know much about Tibetan. I would probably have to really immerse myself in Tibetan to talk to you about Tibetan. But that's very much part of our tradition, that kind of a map. Second kind of map, second and third kind of map, come out of China. Because we're Zen, and Zen is Chan, and Zen started in China. And there's some different premises here. First of all, in China, Chinese Zen from the beginning is you can experience enlightenment in this lifetime. You can and you will if you practice. You'll experience it in this lifetime. In India, we have the karma and we had the caste system, and there's much more of a sort of belief that what you've got in this lifetime limits you. And you do what you can, but because of karma and the caste system, even though Buddha said he didn't have anything to do with it, it still permeated Indian Buddhism. You can only do so much. Just try to be moral, try to be good, and you may, at some point, be ready for some kind of enlightenment experience in this life or 10 lifetimes from now or something. Chinese didn't believe that. Chinese are a little bit like Americans. A poor boy, a poor girl, especially a poor boy. I'm sorry, they weren't good with girls. A poor boy can make good. A poor boy can make good. Confucianism acknowledged a poor boy can make good. A boy who's ignorant can make good. So we can all discover our own natures. Moral behavior is not a prerequisite. In this first path, moral behavior, not eating past noon. I sat on a plane last year with a modern-day Theravadan monk, and it was like, it was 1:15, and they served lunch on the plane, and he just drank water. So there I was. I won't say what I was eating. I was scarfing something or other down, and this Theravadan monk was sitting drinking water next to me. Well, that's the difference in the attitudes, but they're both great. They're both wonderful. I'm not saying which map is better. We're talking about just maps, and maps work better for some people in certain contexts and for other people in other contexts. And Zen is influenced. Chan is influenced big time by Taoism. Taoism made fun of moral convention. Made fun of stereotypical behavior based on rules and regulations. And the Taoist sages, they fished, they ate fish, they drank wine, and they had families. So we have that coming in, and Zen being a product both of the Buddhism that's passed down from India and what was going on historically with the Taoists in China. So then Vimalakirti becomes the Indian who's the most revered in this new Chan movement, and Vimalakirti, because he's really wealthy, but he doesn't have to give up his wealth. He just there with it without being too attached to it, enjoying it but sharing it with others. He's really wealthy, and he says that he tells everybody who comes that they can attain enlightenment without destroying the moral and cognitive poisons, the kleshas. The kleshas don't have to be destroyed. it's one thing to be just totally taken away by them, but they don't have to be destroyed. So the eighth step in the path, meditation, becomes the important step. And Huineng, who is the kind of the father of all this, says that meditation and wisdom and enlightenment are one. So they're not two. They're completely the same. So a moment of meditation is an evocation of enlightenment. So then out of this Chinese background, two trends develop. And the first trend, I think we can say, comes from Bodhidharma, comes from Joshu, Chaocho, and comes from Linchi, Rinzai. And that's the your hair is on fire approach to practice. Your hair is on fire approach. Well, not your hair. But the idea that we're in a lot of pain, that if we're already our hair's on fire, and we should practice as if our hair's on fire. We should make our questioning, our zazen, do that with a sense of urgency. And if we practice as if our hair's on fire, if we do that with urgency, if we do all the retreats we can, if we do as much sitting as we can, and if we just force ourselves to come back every time our mind wanders, that we can have a breakthrough. We can have a great breakthrough. And if doubt comes up, we just confront that doubt. So it's a challenging shaking up of the psyche. And if you look at the interchanges between those Chinese guys in the 7th, 8th, 9th century, often it seems like, boy, they're not being very nice to each other. Anybody ever get that feeling? They're not being very nice to each other. Well, the teacher is trying to shake things up, trying to shake the other. And so somebody said to me, well, when I read those Chinese stories, it seems like everybody's in a fighting spirit realm. Well, the teacher is often in that realm to try to evoke, to try to provoke, to try to people to break through, to stick with it, so that they can really experience this enlightenment in this lifetime, in this body, in this session, in this retreat. So very provocative. And Suzuki Roshi was usually very mellow, but sometimes in sashins, God, I thought he was like a lion. He was going to devour me when I just wanted a glass of water. But this is something we've been doing for centuries, to try to shake up your psyches. You get so entrenched. You get so entrenched. And with nothing to distract yourself and just a wall, there's a chance for you to return to this wonderful experience of enlightenment. And if you read, a couple of people told me recently they were reading Philip Kaplow's book. I have not read his book, probably. His big, thick book, Three Pillars of Zen. Haven't read that in probably, 20 years or something. But in that book, there are stories. He talks about determination and doubt, and then he gives stories of people's enlightenment experiences in terms of his own, and including his own. And Jack Kornfield does too. And here are a couple of experiences which come out of this second map. And these are by people who are currently Zen teachers. They're not identified here. This guy said, I've been busting my butt practicing. sitting. I'd gone to one retreat after another, and I got some concentration, some calmness, and then I lost it, and I went back to just thinking I could never get anything, but I kept doing it, even though I was exhausted. Then I went into spring retreat. I remember experiencing a deep, pure meditation and thinking I was beginning to find what I had quested for. But I knew enough to just let it go and meditate some more. Then on the fourth day, and it takes, our retreats, we have half-day retreats. Those are cool, and one-day retreats, but actually this takes a long time. I recommend lots of long retreats. Sorry. I don't know any other way. Then on the fourth day, my mind fell into chaos. And I thought, well, I was wrong. But instead of using my concentration as a sword to cut the confusion away, casting all out except the luminous ground, I embraced the chaos with all my heart. Then body, mind, and the world started to open. It was like a great wave opening over me. I was filled with joy and clarity. It was both empty and full, cool winter and warm spring together. I felt I could understand everything. This went on for days, for weeks. I remember at the retreat sitting in the middle of the afternoon when everybody is tired and stiff and struggling, and I was so happy. We would go to see the Zen master who would ask his impossible questions, and I smiled to myself, oh, I know the answer to this. But I just kept sitting. The energy built and built. Finally, I went into the teacher, and he asked one of the oldest koans, punctuated with a small hand gesture. With this gesture, the whole room fell away. Everything was gone, the wind, the stars, the dogs outside. We all disappeared into the same vastness. There was nothing and everything, and I laughed and laughed in astonishment. I knew the mind of my teacher, I knew the age of the world, my body was transparent, the blowing of the wind was my breath, my steps were the earth moving herself. After this, life was joyful, alive, and my oldest fears were washed away, just gone. I was finally truly alive. And even though I was smiling for weeks and months, it was an odd thing. I didn't tell anyone in the community what was happening because I knew somehow that people would feel left out. In that way, I immediately became aware of all the painful limitations in this world, how even with the great openness, the limitations must absolutely be respected. So there are several of these, but I think that's enough. It gives you a taste. So that's the second kind of map. And the third kind of map is the map that comes from the Hongzhi Dogen tradition. Although, if you really read Dogen, he's got all three. He's got all three. I mean, the wonderful thing about him is he's a Catholic with a small C. Not Catholic. He's a Catholic. He's got all three. But the Hongzhi tradition, we're studying Hongzhi now in a morning study group. Every other Thursday morning, you can come join us if you'd like. In that tradition, which also comes out of the same period in China, enlightenment, it's based again on Huineng's idea that enlightenment and practice are not two, that meditation and practice are not two. So enlightenment precedes practice. We're all already enlightened, right? And all practices is an actualization of what we are already. So enlightenment precedes practice. Enlightenment is just a manifestation of practice. Huineng talks about the lamp, and he says there's the lamp and there's the light, and all you do is switch on the lamp. Katagiri Roshi used to talk about this. He didn't identify Huineng, but he said, you just turn on the switch. You just turn on the switch. So the lamp, the meditator, the meditation, and the light. You turn on the switch. And the light manifests your original enlightenment. So in this way, there isn't any much of a trail, which people don't like. There's not much of a trail. Why isn't there a trail? Because you're already enlightened. All you have to do is turn on the light. Is there a trail to turn on the light? No, just turn it on. What are the instructions for turning on the light? Where should I put my hand? The light is right there. Turn it on. The enlightenment is right here. Turn it on. No, just act that way. Just do it. So Zazen is an expression of enlightenment instead of the other way around. And Dogen says, foolish people think that at the time one is studying the way, only when one has acquired Satori, that's those experiences that experience I was reading about, is it enlightenment? They do not understand that when one musters one's entire mind and body and practices the Buddha way, This is the entirety of the Buddha way. So anytime we make wholehearted effort to sit, to listen, to prepare tea, if we do it wholeheartedly without judging, that's the enlightenment of the universe. The light is shining out from our lamp. That's it. Anytime. So in Bendo, Dogen says, do not think that there is any enlightenment outside of practice. If practice is practiced based on enlightenment, practice has no beginning. So enlightenment for the Hongji Dogen approach is not an experience, it's an activity. It's just an activity. And it's not following some rule, although the rules are fine, and the rules are good, but it's going beyond the rule and joining with this moment. Just joining with this moment. This moment's already joined with you. Why don't you, all you have to do is pay attention. That's all you have to do. Just pay attention. So Dogen, then, when he gives instructions for meditation, he doesn't give too many instructions, right? So, you know, his famous treatise on meditation, Fukan Zazengi, what does he tell us about how to meditate? What does he tell us about shamatha and vipassana, you know, how to calm ourselves? And well, here he is. Here's our friend Dogen. And when he's recommending Zazen to all people, oh, he's going to recommend it. He's tell me how to do this, right? This is very famous. We all learn how to meditate. What does he say? He says, having adjusted your body, take a breath and exhale fully. Then sway your body to the left and right. Okay. Now sit steadfastly and think non-thinking. How do you think non-thinking? Beyond thinking. This is the essential art of Zazen. That's all he says in this whole thing about Zazen. That's all he says. So you may love that, you may hate that. But this is a map with no trail because you turn on the light. You turn on the light. And then if you get involved in some huge technique to turn on the light, you're never turning it on. You're always trying to perfect your technique. You're always comparing my technique to Rosemary technique to your technique. Instead of just turning it on. So, we make our effort in this moment, our wholehearted effort, to evoke an enlightened response, which means a response based on what is in this moment, whatever it is. Making soup, playing with your granddaughter, whatever, what it is. You make your effort and that's the enlightened mind coming out. The mind of the universe is coming out. So when I do this initiation, we do this initiation ceremony on the 29th, and people will say after toward the end of the ceremony, the people who everybody who's here will say, the Sangha is the complete life. And this also comes from Dogen, the Sangha is the complete life. And Sangha just means community, and it means the community of all life, this huge family of life. That's the complete life. So in every moment, we're with a member of our family, and we have a chance to express our original enlightenment with a member of the family, even if it's just a word, a worm in the soil out there. Just to see that worm, help it find a new home if it's caught by some cement or whatever, just to be there with our family. It's a complete family, complete life. So, before I close, then, a little bit about a little more about each of these different maps, okay? So the first map, the Theravadan map, does have some real virtues. It can be very, very helpful. Sometimes you need some steps to follow, or you'll just be lost. You need some specific steps. You need to think in a linear way, in a rational way, or you'll just be lost. And that's very good, and you have to pay attention to your behavior. You have to pay attention to whether you're harming yourself or someone else and your cognitions. That stuff is very necessary and very good. And the precision in which they articulate the path is remarkable. It's really, the first one is Buddhist psychology. Zen doesn't have much Buddhist psychology in it, in the way that psychologists talk about changing behaviors and gradually through cognitive behavioral approaches. So it's great, but what's its limitation? Its limitation is that we can get really caught by the map, get really caught by the finger that's pointing to the moon, and forget that this is about the moon, not about the finger. And we can be comparing, as they did, who is more moral, who does better at not eating before noon, and who tries to sneak a snack, and who does what, and become very judgmental, very rigid, et cetera, et cetera. So it has its drawback, its strength and its drawback. And the second one, the second map, the one in which we believe in our heart of hearts that in this lifetime we can attain enlightenment. In this lifetime we can return to complete stillness, where there's no trace of self or other. There's just openness and interdependence and the quiet joy that comes out of that. You believe that and you strive to see that and experience that by sitting at facing a wall, a stupid wall, day after day, moment after moment, retreat after retreat. But you believe you can do that. And that's very American. That's very American. Think of all the people who start at 20 years old and say, oh, I'm going to try to make $1 million. I'm going to climb Mount Everest. You know, this is our American adventurous, entrepreneurial, pioneer spirit. Boy, what about if a quarter of those guys, and mostly guys, who set out to make $1 million, really set out to attain enlightenment? If they put in as much effort in attaining enlightenment as they do making $10 million or a million, what would the world be like? I really wonder, what would it be like here in the United States? If only half a quarter of those people did that, it'd be something, wouldn't it? It'd be something. So that practice is a great practice. What are the limitations of that practice? Well, for one thing, that practice can be kind of competitive, kind of rough-edged. It can sometimes seem like it's everybody is just in a fighting spirit realm the whole time. Everybody is just competing. Where's the compassion? Where's the openness? Where's the love of the moment? And I was in a sesshin once where they were doing this kind of practice, and it was time for Dokusan, and the Dokusan bell rings, and everybody runs. Everybody runs to get in line to see the teacher. And the first person who runs the fastest gets to see the teacher first. So, I mean, it seems ridiculous, doesn't it? But let's not be too critical. Let's not be too critical. But on the other hand, see the other side. See how it can turn into spiritual materialism. See that. See that. That's why I haven't read Philip Kaplow's book in 20 years. Because I don't generally teach that way. But sometimes I do teach that way. Especially in sesshin, I get pretty revved up sometimes. You might not want to come being sesshin. You may think I'm just on an ego trip. No? Okay. I don't care. Well, I do care. I do care. Yeah, I do care. The third one. Well, the third one, of course, the wonder is that the wonderful part is that wherever we are, we just have a chance to be open and still and caring and empathic, and that's enlightenment. Enlightenment's not a special technique. It's just being here completely engaged, completely open. So that's enlightenment, whatever it is. Whatever it is. So we don't have to look for some top of the mountain, because this is the top of the mountain. It's the bottom of the well, too. It's the top of the mountain. The top of the mountain is at the bottom of the well. We don't know. We're just here. So, but the downs, and the, so that one tends to be really sangha-oriented, really community-oriented, not competition-oriented. Because who are you competing against when you're at the top of the mountain and the bottom of the well, both? Well, nobody you compete against. You and yourself don't have to compete against yourself because you're resting in stillness. You're resting in original enlightenment, always. But the downside is what? Well, the downside is sometimes sort of passivity. Oh, yeah. Hey, I just sit. I don't have to calm my mind. I just sit, and then I just go do the dishes, and then I don't have to get involved in any of this strenuous activity. And the other downside is that you can get confused in this third one because you don't have much of a map. You've got no trail and just a little bit of a map. And you can think, oh, God, this is not skillful means. This is not skillful. So my friend, I have a friend named Sheridan in Berkeley, and she practiced with me in San Francisco at Zen Center for a long time. And but now she's a Vipassana. She practices Vipassana. And still lives in Berkeley and has been practicing Vipassana for about as long as she practiced Zen. And I went to visit her in Berkeley a few years ago, and she said, well, you're still doing Zen. Well, she said, I always knew you would. She said, I expected you'd be a teacher. She said, but you know, those years that we were with Suzuki Roshi, I never knew what was going on. I was so confused about what we were supposed to be doing and what he was saying and how to do Zazen. And she said, now in Vipassana, it's so much easier for me and so much clearer, and I have these different markers and these different anchor points. And so that's a good example. Good example. So anyway, we have these three different maps, and then of course Tibetans have their own map, and there are lots of different maps. There are lots more maps, but in our tradition we mainly have these three. And they're all to point out something huge and something wonderful, which really can't be mapped out, other than just tentatively mapped out. So I'll close with a story I told last time, which is the Zen teacher who was dying, and students went to crowd around to see him, get his last words, get instruction on how they should be, and he said to them, he looked at them and he said, truth is like a river. I said this last week. I don't know why I'm still giggling at it. Truth is like a river. But then the teacher didn't die right away. He thought he was going to die. He thought he was going to die. But he didn't die right away. He still was in bed, still watching TV or something. I don't know. I'm contemporizing. Making this contemporaneous or something. And the students were off meditating, and truth is like a river, truth is like a river, truth is like a river. And then, but he hadn't died, and a week had gone by. And so the head monk, the Eno, came back, and he said, well, you know, we've all been reflecting on what you said, and we want a little more help on this, because this is just a little confusing, this truth is like a river. We're trying our best. And so give us a little help. And the teacher looked at him. He said, truth is not like a river. And the teacher died. So that's the end of my talk. Questions, comments? Anybody have any questions or comments or concerns?
Because you started off with the story, and the little boy stands up at the top of the hill and says, yeah, I just took a step. How does that fit in with the maps?
Well, how do you think it fits in?
Well, it comes back to the second path where it's all competition. It's what are we competing about?
Mm-hmm.
We just took a step. And it is just taking the step. It's just flipping on the switch. It's just that moment you take that step.
So
it's really nothing. It's actually just taking the step.
You can say that. I mean, you can look at this story developmentally if you want, but don't be too attached to that. That is, that at first in our practice we need a lot of help, a lot of support. So we should work on the Eightfold Path, and we should do a shamatha, and then we're ready vipassana, but not even do vipassana for a while because we need a good trail with a good map. But then as we get a little more into it, a little more mature, whatever that is, I don't know. I don't really trust that word. But a little more something or other, ripe maybe, a little more ripened, then we're able to let go a little bit of the trail and just use the map to come back to stillness. But at some point, we're able just to let go of the map completely and realize that enlightenment has always been here, always been right in the middle of our confusion, right in the middle of our pain, that the enlightened mind never leaves us. And when we see that, then one step, two steps, 10 steps, a billion steps, it's all the same, completely. Well, that's one way you think about it, is developmentally. But don't get too attached to that.
Okay. They aren't necessarily sequential.
Yeah.
But people have some people are more literal, some people are more
conceptual.
That each path has its own.
That's actually better. I like that better because if you think of developmentally, then you kind of think, well, the shamatha vipassana stuff is for people who aren't very advanced. Mm-hmm. And that's not legitimate. So I actually like your take on it better.
The other comment or question or something that I just want to throw out is it seems that American Buddhism sort of combines everything.
Yeah.
Or is sort of
we are. We're doing that.
We're mixing everything up. what's your take on that?
Well, we're Americans. My take is that this is fine, but I'm an American. I think it's great. So, you know, I think it's great. I mean, you heard the banana split story when you talked about a lot. Yeah. So, I mean, I like banana splits. there's a disadvantage. The disadvantage is that we'll treat our practice like a spiritual supermarket. That's a big disadvantage. We'll get into a spiritual supermarket. String beans. Which type of fish is better? Running around. We'll spend all of our time running around Lund's or running around Rainbow or running around the Wedge instead of just eating a carrot. just completely eating a carrot. That's a disadvantage. That's what I think.
Yeah. I just wanted to add, if you ever read the book of Goldsmiths, Glenn Dharma book, it's a good place to start.
Huh.
Because I think he makes a consistent Buddhist argument. And it's not mixing it up.
Uh-huh.
He looks at it. Historically, Buddhism goes off in many directions. No television, etc., becomes disconnected.
Pardon?
It becomes disconnected with these various regional
traditions.
So he's making an argument about how do you take these things and produce a vibrant one dharma.
Other people? Yeah.
So, using the analogy of a path or a map, usually a map leads somewhere.
Yes.
And the third situation that you talked about, if I'm understanding it correctly, enlightenment is just with you along the path.
Right.
So where does the path lead?
Well, the third one, we don't have a path. We have a map, but no path. That is, we have some description of, like, when he talks about meditation, he doesn't give you a path, but he does say, sit down, think non-thinking, get your body erect. That's a map. It's not a path because there's nothing sequential in there. We say shikan in the Japanese teachers say shikan, just do this, just engage. That's a map, but there's no path because you're engaging wholeheartedly, and that's all there is to it. But it is still a map. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Uh-huh. So if we mix up all three,
yeah,
in an American way,
yeah,
what would the path lead?
To here. It always leads to here.
Was it like on MapQuest where you had? Show me where this is, or you can say, how do I get from here to there?
No, in a way, and in early Buddhism, in Theravada, and Shamatha Vipassana, they do both. They do both. And in Hongzhi's way, he barely does anything. He's very evocative, very poetic, very beautiful, right? But he has a little map of this poetic, changing, aesthetic map. But it's hardly a map, and there's no path, right? Because there's no place to go.
Could you also say, though, if you're
going to
have this experience, you need to be concrete. Destination is here. You're already here. It's waking up and being in this moment.
Mm-hmm.
That is, we kind of tell myself,
uh-huh.
Wake up, Lillian. Be right here. That's all you have to do. Be here.
That's right. Yes. Okay. Well, then you'd be pretty good with the Hongzhi approach. It would resonate with you. It would resonate with you. Yeah. What path did I or do I? Well, pardon? What's been my path? Well, see, I've done all these things, and I don't know. What path do I follow? I just do what I'm doing. I don't know. I do one thing. Sometimes I plan. Sometimes I sit. Sometimes I sleep. Sometimes I get mad. I don't know what path I follow. I've tried all these different things in my life, though. And it's always been Zen. It's always been in a context of Zen. But I can't answer that question. Sorry.